It's Wednesday, May 19th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 191 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 55 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
This is Chris.
And I'm Ed.
I'd like to welcome Ed Healy back to the show, one of our recurring guest hosts. I actually think Ed is our only recurring guest host.
I feel like we're some sort of hip-hop video with where it's Fear the Boot featuring Ed Healy or something
hip,
like that.
Hip-hop. Hip to the hop. Hippity-hop.
Featuring Ed, he is. So, I'd love to have some announcements for you guys. Reyna's Wings is still going on. The Blood Bowl League just kicked off. Looks like it's going well so far, but it's too late to sign up for this season. Some people were asking if we're going to do additional seasons after this one. I have no idea. It just depends on how this all works out. We're also looking at some possible redesigns of the Fear the Boot site, at least minor ones to add some new links. But these are all works in progress. I don't have anything to announce. So I'm sure as much as this breaks your guys' heart, we're just going to dive right into the main subjects.
Yeah!
I see Chris's mom is over.
Hi, Mom.
Ed, you sent me a link to an article on innovation versus evolution and whether people actually want innovation or not in a game. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about the content of that article. And for anyone that's curious, I will link the original article off the show notes so you can see what it is we're talking about.
Yeah, well, what it is an article on a guy named PsychoChild's blog, and it's called The Innovation Paradox, and it's dealing particularly with MMOs. But what he's saying is that, you know, you talk to people in the game industry, and you ask them, you know, what's bugging them about their games, and they're like, there's no innovation. And his thesis is, well, that's because people aren't buying innovation. People are buying panache.
There's an infinite circle here, and I want to get your guys' take on where this starts. Because it seems like there's a cross blame here. On the consumer side, the consumer says, well, the problem is the suits and the big companies aren't putting out anything innovative. They look at something that's already succeeded. They look at a way to polish it, which is where the evolution, I don't think evolution is the word that he uses, but they look at a product that's already succeeded. We know RTSs work. How can we make RTSs better? Mm-hmm. We know the MUD style of MMO works, EQ, World of Warcraft, Ad Infinitum, all these MMOs. How can we make that style of grinding out levels, grinding out loot better? And they turn that out. And on our side, we say, and our side being the consumer side, we say, well, the problem is nobody in the game industry is innovating. But the people in the game industry turn around and say the reverse thing, which is either number one, that's because you guys don't buy innovation when we turn it out. Mm-hmm. Or number two, because innovation, because it's new, is going to be messy, is going to be imperfect. It's not going to work out right because it's never been tried before. It's not been tested. There's going to be a lot of quirks. We spent so much time innovating. It's not going to be as graphically clean as something that's been there for a while because you got
it's going to break.
Yeah. And you have a limited budget of time, money and man hours. You got to spend somewhere. And if we're spending it on innovating, we're not spending it on polish. And you guys won't pick it up. Which one of those do you think is more correct? Because I'm sure both are true to an extent. But if you had to pick one of the two, which one do you guys think is more correct?
I think the market will dictate. So basically for me, I look at it and I think that initially something comes out and it becomes popular. Could be a video game, could be a role-playing game, doesn't matter what it is. People buy it. The companies look at that and they say, okay, why was this a hit? What did people enjoy about this? And then it's a natural thing for them. They want to make money, so they're going to release more of a similar product. If they try something new and people don't buy as much of it, then it's just cementing that mindset that we should be doing what we've done before, what worked well. We should just be improving on that. And if you have something out there and it's successful, why would you go back and reinvent the wheel when you can just spend less time polishing that and making it better and having more money come out of it in the process?
I think you're right with that take, Wayne. That's more the corporate intellect, I think. What you just said, the business model is don't rock the boat, stay with what works. We can spend a little bit on some R&D or whatever, but we're not going to fully commit to anything until we know that it's working. I think you're right. You know what you said, Dan, that number two usually is messy. So you don't necessarily, you don't really want to go that route. So
he is a parrot. I'm sure he has firsthand experience of this.
Yeah. So on the consumer's end, we do really want something new. So I guess, like you're saying, we want the innovation, but, you know, it's like what Ed was saying in this. It is risky because it's something different. It's not what you've been doing. It's not what you've been playing and what you're used to.
Yeah, you know how you're to play trying... this. This new thing is new and confusing, and you have a learning curve, but you're already used to playing this. If it just looked better, if it could do more...
Yeah.
You might.
It's like variety is the spice of life. I know one of the examples that you mentioned before we started recording, Ed, was the first guy that said, hey, let's try a role playing game without dice. Right. I mean, that's something truly innovative. That's totally different. But what do you do? It's like, well, we haven't done it before. And everybody's going to balk because they're like, what do you mean we're going to sit down and do a role playing game without dice? I've got my 50 pounds of dice here. What the hell am I going to do with it?
Well, you know, that's the question. Is that really innovation or is that evolution as well? You're taking something that already exists, a format, and you're saying, how can I tweak this to make it better? Well, I want to try it without dice. Yeah, that is both innovative, but it's also
evolution. You're splitting hairs there. There comes a point when evolution is innovative, where you're not taking baby steps. You're jumping far ahead. And typically when that happens, you get a new category. You get D&D out of war games. You get Magic the Gathering. You get the HeroClix. Or, you know, you get something totally different, totally innovative, and totally new.
That's why I've always found categories to be kind of a semantics argument. I mean...
Well, I think it's only a semantics argument if we make it a semantics argument. I mean, on the one hand, okay, maybe this gets into the whole fuzzy logic thing of at the loss of which hair is a person balding. Is the car an evolution of the chariot? Sure. But let's call the internal combustion engine innovative over the chariot.
Exactly.
And in the same way, I would look at a game like Amber Diceless. Is Amber Diceless an evolution of D&D in some roundabout way? Sure. But I think at the same time, when you are taking the entire random decision-making game element out of the RPG, just play along with the fuzzy logic. I see your point, Wayne, and I'm not saying you're wrong, because you're not wrong. But for the sake of this discussion and just setting some boundaries on it, let's just say that that is innovation and not evolution. In the same way that a brand new computer game, even though it's still played on the computer with the mouse and keyboard, we'll call it innovative, even if in a sense it is still borrowing from some prior experience. I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, the Book of Ecclesiastes, you have the phrase, there's nothing new under the sun. And that was written, 3,000 years ago.
And I guess my point wasn't that it wasn't innovative. It's just that innovation versus evolution versus all that are just potentially semantics arguments.
Right.
Yeah, but then we're not talking about anything. You have to draw the line somewhere. It's like, what's the difference between blue and purple? Well, everyone knows that they're different colors, but you could say, well, actually, they're just different shades of light. Well, yeah, we know that, duh. But you can't talk about shades of light. You have to call them something. So we decided they're colors.
You know, I think the populist in me wants to rail against the establishment. I want to say the problem is that the game companies out there are turning out too much stuff that's all the same. I will just say game companies. I'll say music companies, novel publishers, movie companies. They do certainly take the safe road in many cases. But at the same time, I think if you look at the limited economics of development that you can only spend, as I said before, so much time, money, whatever, on developing something. And if you spend it on figuring out how to break the mold, it won't be spent on polish. That I think when, to dust off an old chestnut, the rubber hits the road, that you really do have a problem on the consumer side. I can think going through the MMO industry, just as an example, of various MMOs that really tried to be innovative and break the mold, and people did not latch on to them for one of two reasons. One, you try to pitch it to your buddy, and he can't wrap his head around it. I don't see how that would be fun. It doesn't fit in with what I've already played in EQ or World of Warcraft or Eve or whatever. So I don't see how that would be fun. And there's no selling point there. Even a lot of the people I sold on Eve, I did so by telling them it was just like Trade Wars. The second thing I would say is in a lot of people that you do convince to pick it up say, well, there's bugs, there's imperfections. This isn't as deep as I would like it to be. And so they give up on it because it doesn't have the benefit of a legacy that sits behind it. It's an innovative idea. And so they don't stick with it. And so the people that sit at the corporations whose job is not to entertain you, their job is to make money. They just so happen to do it by generally entertaining you, says this isn't profitable. and ditches the idea. Possibly, and this is where I'll go back to the populist side, I think sometimes they ditch an idea unfairly without asking why it failed. I can think of TV shows. Let's just take Family Guy's the easiest one. They ditched Family Guy because it wasn't doing well. What they never bothered to look at is it wasn't doing well because they wouldn't leave its time slot alone. Nobody could follow the show. Yep. And in the same way,
I think that particular point, Dan, happens. Actually, I think that happens more often than it doesn't happen. I think that there is very little analysis as to, you know, why did this not succeed like we thought it was going to succeed? And it's quickly killed. I mean, I've seen it happen more often than not. That, to me, really, you know, if you want to go look into the non-gaming world, I think that's part of the reason why NBC had as much trouble as it did, because and got itself in the position it did. I mean, yes, it did have plenty of crappy programs that came up, but they didn't give the programs that were good and were worth keeping a chance to stick around and find that audience. They wanted too many quick hits, and they just weren't getting them, and so they ditched too many really good shows.
Well, look, here's the thing. Innovation needs one of two things. Either it needs a small company, because the truth is that innovation is risky. And when you have a big company with lots of employees and a lot of things that you have to do,
shareholders,
you need to make the play that's going to make money, like Dan was saying. And there's no apologetics for that. The truth is it's harder for a big company to innovate. We all know that smaller organizations, look at the startups in Silicon Valley. The smaller guys are the ones that are more nimble, that can move faster, that can move further with less. But eventually, look at, you know, the Borg book that is now Facebook. You know, they're taking Dig, they're taking Twitter, they're taking Gowalla and Foursquare, all those things that these smaller companies have made, and they're going, we're going to assimilate you. You know, we're going to take all those neat features and we're going to put them into Borg book, and we're going to basically thank you for the idea. But on the other side, you have, I mean, look at the game, and here's a good example. Wizards of the Coast is arguably the biggest RPG publisher, right? But if you look at the innovation that's happened in RPGs over the years, it didn't come from the White Wolves and the AEGs and the Paizos and the Wizards of the Coast. It came from the small guys that are, you know, like Dogs in the Vineyard, and the small guys selling like little teeny games. But if you look at the 4th edition Dungeon Master's Guide, it borrows heavily from the story games crowd. It borrows heavily from the indie crowd, and it assimilates these great ideas that the small guys took risks on because of art or because of whatever, because they were willing to take that risk that Wizards could never take. But once those ideas were proven, Wizards adopted those things and included them in what is arguably not a story or indie game. Just to go back to your TV example, if you have a big company to innovate, you need a champion that believes in it. And one example I'll give is the X-Files, our TV show. That thing was on the ropes for years, but it had a champion in the company that believed in it, and it survived long enough to be what it became, a 12 or 13 season show.
You know, and that's one thing, is that the larger a company gets, and it's not just role-playing, again, this is across every industry, the larger a company gets, their own success can be something that's holding them back.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have people whose lives now depend on this.
Sure.
If it's a small company, if it's a hobby, if it's a side thing, you can afford to take more risk because you're not worrying about putting dinner on your family's table. But when you suddenly have, even if it's only five, but when you suddenly have people that are reporting to you, that are working for you, you have to think, if I go out on a limb and this fails, these people might not eat. So your very success is holding you back from taking the risk that you need to take to succeed or fail.
Yeah, I mean, like, love it or hate it, the OGL was innovative for the RPG industry, in a sense. And without the champions, you know, like Dancy and others that were championing it at Wizards of the Coast, it would never have happened. In the face of opposition from a large company, it came to be because it had a champion or a group of champions inside that organization. Without that, I don't think we would have ever had the OGL.
You know, I actually like how this topic is sort of tying in with what we talked about a couple episodes ago where we were talking about indie games and small games. I mean, it's interesting because we're talking about the fact that the sort of the cycle of the industry is you need the little guys. They're the ones that are being truly innovative because, well, they have to be to exist because they have to do something different. The big guys are already doing it and they're doing it well.
The little
they
guy
have to have a new idea.
The little guy can't win with D&D.
Exactly. If you come out with, if the little guy comes out with what's already there, why bother? So they have to be innovative. But then at the same time, the industry to evolve, it sort of sucks up those little guys and assimilates what they're doing. So there you go. You've got to have those indie games for this industry to get better, to sustain itself.
Phrase that way. If we presume that that is, in fact, the model by which things operate, I almost feel sorry for the small press and hobbyist guys, which would include us, I guess, because it's those people that go out, take the risk, make the gamble, come up with the ideas, and in many cases don't get bought out, but just watch their ideas, their unprotectable ideas, get consumed by a larger, more profitable company.
Yeah.
And
if they're lucky, they end up working for that company. If they're unlucky, they lose.
Well, I wouldn't feel sorry for them, because most of them do it for love of what they're doing. I mean, in this industry anyway, most of the indie guys that make their game, they do it because they love what they're doing. And so they're not really looking to be the next big company. They're just looking to make a game that the guys who appreciate that type of game will play and go, man, Bill, that was a great game. I really like how you changed this here. Well, thank you. They're not really trying to be, you know, the next Paizo that just comes from behind and like gives D&D a run for its money. I don't believe that's what they're after.
And those big guys, they love you for it. They love those kind of guys. Yep. They're just in it for the love of the game. And you know what I'm saying? It's like you're saying, I agree with you, but at the same time, it would be nice for those guys to get, you know, what they're due.
Well, and I guess this is where I would offer a piece of advice that to anyone who supports the populist side of the equation, that wants the innovation, that blames on some level the suits, quote unquote, for squelching innovation, the best thing you can do is vote with your pocketbook, vote with your time. If that type of thing is what you want, then don't sit there bitching about how the suits are ruining the industry while you're playing D&D. I mean, I'm not saying don't play D&D, but go out to some of these places, you know, like Evil Hat or whatever, and pick up some of these small press books, pick up some of these innovative ideas, give them a try. And if you believe in them, try to get other people to buy into it. The same thing you can do this with TV, movies, whatever. Be involved in that. Give some recognition to those people. Give some money to those people.
Yeah, I think we've seen some real evidence. I mean, going back to the television, you've seen some real evidence in the last few years of what the fan base can do. I mean, they can save shows.
Yeah, look, you know, at
it's
what
like
happened
the writing
with
campaigns. Yeah, Jericho, that's the best one that I can think of. But there's stuff like that. And this is the same thing. Like you're saying, Dan, go out there and support those smaller games. Give them a shot. Maybe you don't, because you're just a D&D fan and that's what you really like to do. But just try something new.
The sad truth, though, is getting back to this guy's argument, is that the truth is that most people don't want innovation. Most people want polish. And there's a small subset of this small subset of a small industry that we're in that want innovation. The rest of us, we just don't. And that's the argument he's making. I think he's right on track there. He's like, look, people say they want innovation, but really what they want is a nice, pretty coffee table book that they can play with as many people as they can find. They're not really interested in, let's say, finding an indie game that's innovative and then building a game group around it and teaching other people to play. That's not really what they're after.
Well, but I think what the most interesting and perhaps incendiary part of his argument, as best as I follow it, is that most people, though, will tell you they want innovation.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, when the rubber actually hits the road, that's not what they're really doing. You know, they'll tell you they want innovation, but then they will bail on an unpolished innovative product.
Sure.
And it's not just the fact that they're bailing on the unpolished product, but it's the fact that at the time they're unwilling to make that engineering balance of, you know, if you want something that's faster, it's got less pulling power and vice versa. If you want something that's more innovative, it's going to be less polished. That's just the way the world works. As much as we'd like to see an innovative and polished product, I'm sure somebody out there has an example of an exception. But generally speaking, it's a sort of an either or sort of balance.
You know, and when you think about it, how many times when you ask someone, if you could design the perfect game, whether it be video game, role playing, whatever, what do you hear back? Well, I take this aspect of this one, I take this aspect of this one. How many times do you actually hear a truly original answer? People say that they want originality, they want innovation, but in reality, when they're describing what they want these experiences they've already had. They want to mix and match and make them better and evolve it, never actually asking for something truly innovative.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, the human tendency is it's the fear of the unknown. Like you're saying, I can't tell you, because I haven't thought of this innovative thing, I can't tell you that I'm going to like it because I don't even know what it is.
Yeah, I know this.
If I experience it, I'm like, wow, that's awesome. Or, oh my God, that sucks so bad, I'd never want to play that again. But you just don't know because it hasn't been invented yet. So yeah, a human tendency is to stick with, you know, with what you know.
So if something doesn't sell well because it, you know, is something different, that again goes back to the company looking at it and seeing, okay, this didn't do well because it was different. They don't look at it and say, well, what about it did they not like? It wasn't that it was innovative that people didn't want it, I think. There was something about that innovation they didn't like, or it may really have been it just wasn't what they were used to.
Well, here's the thing. There's a difference between selling to a market that exists and educating people about a product they didn't even know they wanted. And innovation is the second part. Polish is the first part. Coming up with games, like if I say, hey, what would you like to see? And you say, I want to see Aliens meets Cyberpunk meets Warhammer 40K. That's not innovation. That's just, I want to see something different, kind of similar but different than what is already here. That's just selling to what's here. Innovation is creating something that you really have to educate people about. This is new and different. A good example would be the companies who tried making PDFs for on OBS that had video and audio embeds in them, or had, like, Fat Dragon had mapping PDFs that you could click on stuff and it would dynamically change the map so that you could print it out. And all the companies that came back to me said, they just don't sell any better. It's not worth the extra effort. That's innovation of delivery. The economic incentive is not there because either one, they didn't educate their potential audiences to the benefits and convince them that it's worth it. Or two, people did know and just said, screw it, I don't want innovation. I just want my simple PDF. I'm not going to pay extra.
And I continually argue that basically just this evolution without the innovation will not grow any hobby. If you want new people to come in, you can't keep preaching to the people you've already converted. You can't keep just trying to sell to the people you're already selling to. That's not sustainable when it's a demographic that's getting older.
Well, and that's been a problem even, let's pick on ourselves here, that's been a problem within podcasting. If you look at the history of gaming podcasts, I mean, we're about 4 years old. The oldest of the gaming podcasts, I believe, is around 5 years old. Most of them have podfaded, but a couple are still sticking around. But the problem throughout the history of this little subculture is that it's been cross-pollination. We have perfected a science of reaching everybody else's listeners. What we as a group have really failed to do is to make an effective outreach to people who are gamers, who sit in front of a computer all day, but have never tried a gaming podcast. And that's something that we try to break through the interviews, through getting in touch with people in the industry where maybe somebody who doesn't listen to podcasts follows them on Twitter and tries us out the first time because they heard so-and-so's on the show. But let me take this to a new question, a related question, which is, have you guys personally ever taken that plunge? I can think of at least one time in my life I have. I latched onto an idea that sounded stupid, but I was willing to try something as innovative. The experience was several years ago, back in the mid-1990s, and I think I've told this story on the show before. I was sitting over at Chad's apartment, and he's playing this game I have never heard of before called Harvest Moon. And I'm watching him play this, and I'm like, okay, so what's this game about? He's like, you farm. Okay, and what? You're in competition with nearby farms? No. You're saving up for an alien invasion that you've got to defend against? No. You're trying to feed a war effort? No. So what do? Well, you wake up in the morning, you do your chores, you take care of the animals, you try to court a local girl, and you go back to bed. And the next morning, you have enough money for an Uzi? No. And I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me. And so he's like, try it. I'm like, okay, why not? You know, I've wasted enough of my life on video games. Why not waste another 5 minutes? And he hands me the controller and I start up a character. And 5 minutes later, 4 hours have passed. Mm-hmm. And I am, to this day, I still follow the Harvest Moon series. The way I described it to friends of mine, other friends of mine, as I was selling them on the idea, is I have said, never in my life have I cared so much about so little. And I went through the same thing trying to sell it to Mike, to Tim, to Kevin, to all these other friends that I knew. They'd see me playing and be like, what is this game? And I'd just be like, I'm not even going to try. Just play it. And pretty soon, these guys were all hooked in the exact same way. Mm. There's an example of where I actually tried a game that at the time was extremely innovative. There was no guns, there was no aliens, there were no side-scrolling, nothing. I mean, this was a game that was about farming at the micro level. I'm not aware of anything else on the market of any significance that was like it, and I took that plunge. And I'm curious, is there something like that where you guys have taken that plunge? What made you take that plunge, and how did you sell it to other people? And if the answer is no, then why not? And that I don't say as an accusation, more of a question. Let's dissect the problem.
I'm sitting here trying to rack my brain, trying to think of any examples. And honestly,
I think we're all doing that, actually.
Well, yeah, but the thing is I can't, nothing is really jumping to mind. And I think for me, I think part of the reason is that I don't think I've ever really been presented with that opportunity to even engage in that within the gaming circles of that either I ran in before I moved or that I've dabbled in here. It has been nothing outside of a standard comfort zone. There hasn't been really anything super innovative that anyone's ever said, you got to try this. You have to try this. And it just hasn't been.
I did buy Muscle March. That was innovative, and that was something I had never thought to try before.
That's a good example.
That is a good example.
Muscle March is just scary. That's not innovative. That's just downright scary.
Awesome. So I actually did really buy this, and I'm playing it in my living room. My wife comes in, and she's like, what are you playing?
All right, but
I described this game to her, and I say, well, I, you know, Dan showed me this game, actually. She's like, does Carla know he has this? Does she let him play it with her in the room? Because I'm leaving the room now.
Is she worried he's about to run off with Lance? So... No, but I mean, all right, here's the thing, though. You guys say you've never been presented with this, which may be true. I don't know that anyone in your life has ever really come on strong and said, hey, you've got to try this. But come on, there's nobody sitting here who's not heard of Amber Diceless. But how many of you guys have picked it up and played it when the rules, if I'm not mistaken, are freaking free?
You know, actually, Dan, I just thought of one. So there was a while there where I got into web-based games. Like stuff on websites, not like Facebook or things.
Okay.
But these are like, you go to a website and... You put in your turns for the day, and it does.
You're talking about stuff like Legend of the Green Dragon and all that.
They actually have moved those onto the web now, because I used to do those back in the BBS days.
Yeah, back then was Legend of the Red Dragon.
Yeah.
Now it's Legend of the Green Dragon.
So basically, a friend of mine that doesn't get into anything geeky at all came to me and said, I've been playing this game online. And he's describing, I'm like, so wait a minute, you log on to this, you click a couple times, and then you check back the next day. And it wasn't even registering in my mind things like I used to do that on BBSs. I'm just thinking he's going to a website, he's clicking things. He's not actually controlling anything. He's just giving it orders.
Hello, social gaming on Facebook.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, and this was before I'd ever been on Facebook. I actually hadn't even heard of Facebook at that point. I was like, okay, I'll give this a try. And before long, I find that I'm going to the site multiple times a day. They launch another universe, and I have another universe, so I'm really getting into it. And I would have never imagined ever enjoying anything like that, because you're not doing anything.
Well, then here's my challenge for you guys, and you guys not just being the host, but you guys being anyone that's listening to this, is try something out. I'm not saying go out and spend $100 on it. I'm not saying switch your gaming group over, quit your current campaign and pick something new up. But there's tons of stuff out there on the indie market that you can get off of any number of sites for cheap or free. Give them a read through. Think about them. Broaden your horizons a little bit. And if not, that's perfectly fine. How you spend your time and your money is obviously completely your choice. But if not, then I think each of us may have our own reasons, some better than others. But I think that maybe there needs to come a point of confession, at least for a lot of us, that maybe we aren't as interested in innovation as we claim we are. The problem really isn't the suits, but rather that we, as consumers, don't put our money where our mouth is when it comes down to it.
And I think part of that reason might be is kind of what you were talking about with PDFs. Can't remember the name of the company that you said, but that did the changing rooms with the clickable options. Because I've
Fat
seen
Dragon.
Fat Dragon, and there was O1 Games too, I think might be the one that I'm thinking of too. But because
sure.
I saw those and I thought, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. With their little demo ones, I could kind of, you know, figure out on my own the benefits that this might have. But in general, I think that there's an education factor as to giving people reasons as to why they'd like this. For example, going back to Amber Diceless, I would never play that game. I have no desire whatsoever to ever do that, because you'd have to work to convince me as to why I would want to try a game with no dice. Because my mind is set in a certain way that, well, I like dice for these specific reasons, but if you want to try and, you're going to have to try and convince me why it might be better without dice.
Yeah, Chris, I think you've really hit on something there. Something that I've been thinking about through this whole episode is the fact that...
Different does not equal better?
Well, with the difference between, like, the evolution and innovation is the evolution can be relatively quick in terms of making changes and making something different, polishing it. But the problem is with innovation is I think the innovation is a more long-term project or goal. It's not going to be instantaneous gratification. It's not going to be something that's going to be picked up on just like that, it's going to take time. Like, you know, like what Ed was saying, there's a lot of education that has to go into this. People have to be educated as to why they want to do this thing that they've never heard of before. So it's more of a long-term goal as opposed to the short-term gratification of polishing in your evolution. So I think it's just a different mindset that goes into that kind of a thing.
I suppose there's a comment there I made that I actually do want to reemphasize, which is, despite what I'm saying, I don't think that different necessarily equals better. I don't think the fact that somebody has some weird tangential idea makes it automatically better or worthy of your time, attention, and money. I think really more what I'm trying to say is just that I challenge people that if you're going to say that innovation is what you really want, then get out there and at least see what the innovation is. And you may hate all of it, but at least check it out.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Back in 2000, Clinton Nixon posted on Gaming Outpost, said, "Hey, I'm going to have a convention at my house. We're going to call it Apartment Con. And we're just going to do this. We're going to just grab games we have no idea what they are, and we're going to get together and play them." And it was awesome. I mean, this was before OGL and everything. We just, you know, we found Maelstrom Storytelling, and we found some Clockwork game, and we found a bunch of stuff we never heard of, and we just broke them open and one by one went through them, and we're like, oh, that was fun. But I don't do that on a regular basis. You know what I'm saying? It's been years, I've done it since 2000, but it's been years since I just said, I have no idea what this is, let's try it.
You know, I actually do that on a regular basis. At some point, we're going to come back and talk about the board game meetups, but when I go there, I go with the intention of, I want to play things that I've never played and know nothing about. So every time I go, I make an effort to only play games that I've never played before.
But that's easier with board games and card games than it is with playing games.
It's also easier with a group of other people meeting for that reason.
Well, to play off that, I think it's easier at a con game because there's no investment.
Yeah.
Because somebody else has already brought the game, learned the rules, created the plot. All you're investing is a couple hours of your time. If it sucks, it sucks. If it's great, you run down to the dealer room and buy it.
Yeah, and I do that if you're the con. I make a point to play games I would have never even thought about before. And I look to see what's out there that I haven't tried.
That's why I go.
Yeah, I want to experience these new experiences.
All right, so let's move from innovation versus evolution to something that, I don't know, at least in my mind, kind of seems to fit with it, which is bringing a degree of innovation to your role-playing game, but not in the role-playing game, but rather between the role-playing game. Now, before we started recording, we were talking briefly about something called ARGs. Now, for anyone that's never heard of an ARG before, it stands for Alternate Reality Game. And even if you've never heard of it, you have probably seen them before. They've become increasingly popular with books and movies.
Yeah, all of these viral marketing that we're seeing lately have basically grown out of this concept.
Yeah, and so it might be something like, I've got a mystery book coming out, so I create a website for a fake company, and there's clues on this website about something. And if you click through the right little hidden link somewhere and type in the right search term, you get a puzzle. And if you solve the puzzle, you get an email address, and you send an email to that, and you get a response back, and a correspondence begins with some mysterious individual. And after that, maybe you get a little phone call or something like that. But there is a game that you get involved in by which you learn more about this book, movie, whatever, that kind of draws you in on a very personal level. And one of the neat things about it is the fact that it keeps on going. The fact that this is not something where you hop on a website, play for 30 seconds and log off, but you could hop on, play around for a little while, discover something you didn't know was there. You and your friends are working out the puzzles together. 3 days goes by. You've forgotten all about it. I mean, you've been smoking fat J's and can't remember anything. And then all of a sudden you get this email from the mysterious man who has a warning for you or something like that, or you get something in the mail or whatever. And it varies from game to game how exactly these work, but it does a great job of giving you this constant reminder, this constant reinforcement of these games that are going on. And before I dig into this deeper, do you have an example of a game like this that you've seen done recently? Because I know you keep up on this stuff pretty well.
I haven't seen any recently in the RPG space. The last one I saw from an RPG company was the Ethan Haas Was Right game that Mindstorm Labs did for Alpha Omega. And, you know, it got a lot of press because it happened to come out when Cloverfield came out, and people thought it was part of Cloverfield, but it really wasn't. But, you know, they had just this puzzle. The site's still up, actually. essentially. And you can like try to figure out all the little puzzles and stuff, and it gives you clues about the coming apocalypse and stuff. And it was really kind of neat.
Years ago, there was also one for the Da Vinci Code. I don't remember all the details on it, but they had one.
Now, James Ernst and Mike Selinker do Lone Shark Games, and that's kind of like part of what they do is events and ARGs and stuff for people. And you know, they do a lot of that, but I haven't really kept up too much on exactly what they're doing every other day. But I know they do kind of like that event gaming stuff. And a part of that kind of touches on ARGs.
You know, I ran into one a little while ago where the basic concept is they were setting up this world and where they've come up with the technology to create holograms that can touch things. And I actually found it because someone sent me a link to one of the articles on it where they had gone to the site and they thought this was real. So, like, check out this technology. Check out this video.
Well, I went through the same thing with, I won't mention the person who's not on the show, but he's someone I'm closely affiliated with, so I will not mention the person. But there was someone who got a hold of the website for, oh man, was it the Human Continuity Project or something like that? It was for the movie 2012. I can't think what the website was, but it was about some organization. It was a fictitious organization that believed that human life was going to end or nearly end in 2012. And so they were trying to preserve human civilization. And a friend of mine saw it and was convinced it was real. And I had to backtrack through enough of the site to finally show him where there was a jumping off point to the movie site. And I'm like, dude, this is just a trick for the movie.
You know, and in the case of the one I was explaining, it was just a game. It was a pure ARG. There was no movie. There was no product that it was pushing. So it was even harder for me to show them that, no, this isn't real.
Well, they had a minor one like that for Batman Arkham Asylum. They had that whole Arkham Cares website.
Sure, where you could, but that's not necessarily an ARG. I mean,
no, it's not.
A good example would be what Nine Inch Nails has done. Like, they'll go to a concert and they'll go in the bathrooms and leave thumbnails in the like stalls. And people will take those and they'll put them in their computer and get like encrypted files. And they have to go figure out how to break the encryption. And it'll have like a phone number. And you call the phone number and it has like, you know, that's more ARG-ish as opposed to just alternate marketing. You know.
And Lost did a lot of that stuff too a couple of years ago when they had their various things that would happen during the off season to, you know, maintain interest in the show and keep fans engaged and all of that kind of stuff.
Correct. I will agree with you that Arkham Cares may not be the best example because, yeah, that is really more alternate marketing than an alternate reality game. All right. But here's the point, bringing this around now that we've hopefully kind of educated you guys on what an ARG is, if you weren't familiar with them before, is what value does an ARG have to a role-playing game? And if you decide it has value, how can you implement it? Now, let me start this off with the first question of what value does it have? And I think one of the best things it offers is that if you look at a role-playing game in general, particularly the type that we espouse, that has deeper characters, deeper plots, what really draws a person in and keeps them invested is that emotional connection, the storytelling experience. It's all these very, let me whip out the $4 words, esoteric, existential sort of things. All right, it's the experience of playing the game and feeling out the character. And usual disclaimer, I don't mean this in some insane Blackleaf sort of way, but it's the sense that you feel invested in the world and invested in those characters. And one of the problems with the role-playing game, and I used to talk about this all the time with my prior group, is we would have these complex plots going on and we'd come back to the next game. And Mike would always remind me, he's like, Dan, a week or 2 weeks has just gone by. From my character standpoint, no time has passed. He was standing here talking to this guy and he is still standing here talking to this guy. And so there is this disconnect where you plug into that world and then you have to disconnect from it for a while. And you may lose some of that emotional investment, some of that continuity. But if you can find a way through these alternate reality games, through little websites and puzzles and clues, you know, if you've got a big plot going on where it's not clear who the good guy and bad guy is, that they get anonymous tips from emails telling them where to look in the plot or about the next time you're in so-and-so's office, look in his third drawer. The combination is 419. And in there, they find, you know, some weird clue that they have to work with and do these sorts of things that keep the game going both in and out of the game settings. I think it helps keep that sense of emotion, investment, and intrigue alive.
Not only does it help it, honestly, to me, that does nothing but enhance it, because you get into that reality that you're playing when you're around the table, and then you disconnect from it when you're done, the session's over with. But when there's emails coming in, or when there is in character things that are happening that your players can react to when they're by themselves, it enhances that investment and really helps drive the next session.
What we're talking about and what our ARGs are really able to do that RPGs have a weakness at is create a shared experience around a common narrative. What we do in RPGs is we find, you know, five or six dudes or chicks, and we go and we sequester ourselves in our little house. And yeah, we may run through the same adventures, but not in the same way, and not in, you know, in disjointed at different times and in different locations, you know, decades apart sometimes, continents apart. And we don't talk to each other. We're in our own little holes. Whereas things like ARGs particularly, and other things like them, is it gives you that shared community experience that you can go, yeah, I did that too. Like, for instance, I Love Bees, which is the ARG for Halo 2 when that was coming out. I mean, all the people that went through I Love Bees had this shared experience of figuring out the clues and posting it and sharing what they figured out and delving into the secrets of what is this thing, you know? And that brings the community together in a way that playing through, you know, Keep on the Borderlands doesn't really do.
Well, now, just to be clear, though, I think there's a slight disconnect between what I'm talking about, and I think Chris is talking about, and what you, Ed, are talking about. And I think both are valid.
Sure, sure.
From our standpoint, it's what can you do within your own group, whereas you two are talking about what can you do within a community that surrounds a game.
I'm talking about from a publisher's standpoint, simply because right. to do it well and do it right, you're going to need more than one dude's effort and talent.
Right. And that was skipping down a little bit, and we can come back to the subject more, is if you decide to do something like this and you're not a publisher, you just want to do this for your weekly gaming group. There are a lot of hurdles to doing it, including the planning, the amount of time it will take, et cetera, which we can come back to. But briefly, let me do an aside on what you're talking about, which is this is something that I would challenge publishers to do for the exact reason you stated, which is that it gives us a better sense of community and a better sense of connection, is to create these ARGs, not just surrounding my weekly gaming session, but a game as a whole. This is also something I think you could do wonderfully with the release of a module or a series of modules. A great game, I think the game that is meant for this is Shadowrun.
Yeah, I agree.
But the point being, let's say you're about to release three or four or five Shadowrun modules that are meant to be run as a chain. Well, if there are questions left at the end of one of them that might play into the next one, there's a lot there you could develop between the modules in terms of an ARG. Or even if you have a module that might take several sessions to run, you can have a note in there for the GM that, okay, at the end of the first sitting, send them away with this web address. And here's something that they can try and crack that might give them a leg up for the next adventure, or a clue as to which of the three organizations is really the one out to get them versus the other two, which are just obfuscations put out there by the first one. And so I think that there is a lot that publishers could do to prop these things up.
I think even added to that, you know, if we were to stick with the Shadowrun example, but we don't have to, but any sort of modern-based game, if that publisher puts out websites based upon, say, major corporations, government organizations within that game, and just feeds in various bits of data and news items and other kinds of things like that, A, it helps make the world seem a bit more real, and from a campaign side of things, a GM can go in there and maybe pull some, essentially some plot hooks off of certain things like this, and, you know, give in-game handouts or other materials that may, you know, give a nod to that kind of thing, but only the innovative and ingenious players are going to go there and try and, you know, piece things off of that site and maybe bring that back to the next session, which might give them an advantage.
Furthering this idea on, I would love to see the gaming industry really jump on this ARG idea and make it customizable for the customer. Like, Dan, you know, you take whatever world, like, let's just use Shadowrun. You're going to run a Shadowrun campaign. So what they've got is they've got these various things that you can go in, and as the GM, maybe you can modify some of these things or go in there and write some things and define some things that are specific to the game that you're going to run that your players can then go in and find. And it's not just the generic thing that everybody in the world would get, but it's more tailored to what you can do. I mean, I think that would be a great idea.
It's like I'm taking an adventure adventure, and in the adventure, the canon bad guy is Bob Smith. But in my world, my adaptation, it's, you know, Joe Spivey. So I can go in and say, well, Bob Smith character is actually Joe Spivey. So when my guys go there, they don't see Bob Smith. They see Joe Spivey's name. But everything else is the same.
Even more customizations. I'm sure that's really pretty difficult to do.
If it's a website, you can upload pictures to it. You can upload. Look at the sites out there where you can just upload a picture and put it into a Flash video. Yeah, that's kind of a silly, that's a funny way to do it. But you could do something like that here, too, where you're uploading a picture of your players or uploading a picture of, if you've made them go ahead of time and pick a picture that represents their character, you can be uploading these onto a site. And so they're seeing relevant images in there. Or if you have an idea for a villain, you can have that villain up there. You know, something like that to really get them into the world. But it's not just the overall world, it's your world.
I like the idea of that, because when you were talking about originally, Dan, and just, you know, doing it within your own group, the stumbling blocks and the hurdles that I was envisioning was, it's a lot of work. It's a huge effort for the GM, because not only are you getting, you know, you're preparing a game for, you know, your one day a week, but then you're also, you've got to do all this other stuff to engage with possibly each individual player throughout the week. And that's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, and
anything that can help with that would be great.
And think about it, after games, when I've sent you emails, you have to stop and take the time to think about, okay, now that I'm replying to this, I'm replying in character. I'm not giving away this piece of information. So then doing it just on the player level, it puts more effort onto you, because you have to actually craft your replies back to me.
Let's talk about that for a second, though. As much as we can sit here with bated breath hoping that the industry picks up on something like this, and maybe somebody will. I mean, there are companies that have tried this and hopefully will keep trying it in better and better ways. But in the meantime, if we talk about doing this just for your own weekly gaming group, there are certainly, I can think of, three major hurdles that you have to look at or at least weigh out before you get started. But I still think this is doable. And I'm going to get there after I've explained what I think three hurdles are. Number one is, it is added work. You as a game master already have to carry the lion's share of the work in terms of knowing the rules, prepping the adventure, writing the NPCs, juggling everybody's backgrounds and their desires and blah, blah, blah. And so this is something else you are taking upon yourself, and you have to sit down and estimate out, honestly, is this something you can do and keep doing just in terms of the added man hours every week? The second thing is, this is more information to keep track of. Whatever you say, whatever tidbits you put out there, you have to think about how this is going to be perceived, how this might be misleading, how this might be helpful, how this might be unintentionally overly helpful or too much of a reveal. And you have to keep in mind that just as you're giving little plot hints and reveals during the game, there are the separate set of plot hints and reveals you're giving outside of the game. And you have to juggle what happens if they misinterpret or fail to pick up on those. It's more you have to keep track of. The third is, depending on the type of ARG you want to do, this may require some amount of technical know-how. I'm presuming the bulk of people, and I know there are people who can, but the bulk of people here are not going to be able to write an encrypted thumb drive, drop it in a bathroom, expect their players to pick it up, take it home,
right,
notice it's encrypted, and actually go through the effort of decrypting
it. Here's the thing, Dan, to be overly specific, what we're talking about now is not an ARG. We're talking about tools to help with the game. That's not necessarily an ARG, and not to be too much of a stickler about it, but we're really kind of morphing into taking some of the principles of an ARG and how can we apply that on the local level, which is not the same thing. But
well, that's definitely what we're talking about.
Well, and I have no problem with that semantic shift right there. I appreciate the accuracy of your definitions, but yeah, I have no problem with that shift, because that's the way I look at this, is these ARGs are great. But as I said, I don't know that we can just sit here and wait with bated breath for somebody else to take a great idea that we could maybe apply in the interim. But I think there are still things that you can do to keep the sort of thing going.
You can get a free 1-800 number on the internet for free. You could then go and put a voicemail on there. If you're playing Shadowrun or whatever, you know, you could go put a voicemail on there for, you know, what your mission is or whatever. You could integrate that with your Shadowrun game. Like, hey, you know, you guys finished up this. You get a message knowing that, you know, you have to call this number this week before next session so that you can get your mission statement for the next adventure, so you have prep.
I mean, or you stop by your friend's house between D&D games and you stick an envelope with a parchment looking piece of paper in there that has handwritten on it in the splotchy ink to Phytor in room number 4 of the Color Animal Inn. And on the inside is a warning that somebody's coming to assassinate them the following day, or the Baron is not who you really think he is. Go down to a payphone. I know these are increasingly hard to find, but go down to a payphone when you know your buddy's at work, and hopefully his wife's at work as well, so she doesn't freak out and call the cops. And, you know, call and leave some kind of in character message. Get a fake email.
No,
get
a fake anonymous email address.
Talk about technology. If you are if you have an iPhone, you can get the SlyDial app, which allows you to leave a voicemail on somebody's cell phone without actually calling their phone. So that it's kind of cool. You basically put their number in and it'll go straight to voicemail, and you can leave them a voicemail without ever having to talk to them.
But I think there are these little ways that even someone with a limited amount of time and technical know-how can use to sort of keep that feeling going between the games. Now, how do you do this specifically for your game? I'm not sure I have an easy answer, because it's going to be really different based upon the game and based upon the group.
Sure.
So first of all, you have to find something that's organic to the characters and organic to the plot. But once you do that, I think all you have to do is identify some mystery in the plot where there would be a reveal. That it turns out the Baron who's hired you is actually the one who's out to kill you.
Or for disinformation, man. I mean, you could totally use it for that. Just to have fun. I guess here's the key. Take risks and have fun. Try it.
Yeah.
You know?
And if it doesn't work, worst case scenario, no, you've screwed up a game. Okay, let's keep this in perspective.
Have fun with it. Yeah.
But you can find things in the game that are reveals or, as Ed suggested, disinformation. And all you got to do is, instead of revealing these in the game, just sit down and come up with creative, clever, in-character sounding ways of dropping this information on them between the games. So that way, if you game on Sundays like we do, all of a sudden they're getting warnings on Wednesdays. And it kind of helps keep them in character and keep them in the zone. And on top of that, what's going to happen? One of two things. Either, I mean, presuming you didn't make a total ass yourself and these people care. I mean, presuming you have a decent group. The person who picked it up is going to keep it a secret and be stewing about it all week. Or he's going to hop on the phone to the other players and they're going to be trying to disassemble it and dissect it all week long.
Which is awesome.
And yeah, exactly, because you have them hooked. You have them interested and intrigued. And this is something that, once again, I don't think you need 3D in technology and a $200,000 budget to do. I think anyone listening to this show is capable of doing.
Yeah, think about how cool it would be to be, let's say you game on Sunday like we do. On Tuesday, you get a fake news article that is talking about the events that your group did on Sunday. And you're noticing that didn't happen like that. And then you're wondering, is whoever wrote this article, is he have a stake in this? Is this a character I can go talk to?
Especially since where it happened, there was nobody else there.
Yeah.
How could someone even have known this occurred or whatever?
You have so many options if you do something like that and present it for people to go through, and they're going to pick through it.
I did that once back when I was actually running a Shadowrun campaign. This is like in the mid-90s. I took advantage of the fact that I worked at a TV station, and I essentially wrote up a script, a news story script, and talked to one of our anchors who happened to work on the weekend. And when the rest of the people in my campaign, who were also employees of the station, when they weren't around, I basically set them up in our studio and recorded this news segment with him reading the script that I had done, put it onto videotape at the time, and into a VHS tape, and then brought it to the next session and ended up giving it to like one of the players in a package and just kind of gave it to him. They watched it, and then I used that foundationally as what kind of kicked off this next adventure. And there were still some clues in that, you know, in what were written in there, and they had to, you know, try and remember from that before. So it was, I looked at it as more as a prop at the time, but in a certain sense, it is similar to what you're just talking about.
I think this is something that I really like, and I think that, because right now we're at a point where we're probably about to change campaigns in our RPG group. What we do, I think if I end up GMing the next game, this is something I'm going to try. I don't know how yet, but it's definitely something I'm going to try. I hope some of you guys will as well, and hop on the forums or the blog and tell us, man, about how that experience went, what you did, what tips you have to offer to other GMs, and how it worked out, maybe even pitfalls where you went wrong. And
or if you made something, upload it, you know, upload your documents so other people can use it.
Yeah, right. If you guys got some ideas, you know, that'd be great. I think that, like I said, the biggest thing I think that we can take from this episode is trying something that you haven't done before. Try something new, you know,
Also may take advantage of if
expand your thresholds.
Yeah.
If I end up running a fantasy game, is I have a sister who actually is a calligrapher. So I could get her to do handwritten parchment notes and such.
Wow, that'd be cool.
As for the rest of you guys, have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
Later. See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.